Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy, your host for Love What You Play Online Events, and I'm super excited to have a chat with our next guest, Angela Lewis. She is a former collegiate and professional basketball player, has coached at the NCAA Division I level, has coached some championship teams, the author of three books, The Game-Changing Assist, Six Simple Ways to Choose Success, The Game-Changing Assist Workbook, as well as Post Moves, The Female Athlete's Guide to Dominate Life After College. She's been asked to speak at a number of different conferences and worked with non-profits. Really looking forward to chat. Thanks for joining us, Angela.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to chat with you.
So the first question I ask everybody, and this goes back to our first event, and it just kind of sets the tone. So tell us where you grew up and what did you love playing when you grew up?
I love dancing. So not playing dance. So I'm from St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay.
Born here, raised here, lived a few different places, but I was that kid. Anytime the music came on, I'd start rocking. And in the fifth grade, there was a dance competition at my school. And I was really excited. I had one of those asymmetrical hairstyles that we had back in the 90s. And I didn't make the dance team. And so I figured I would do something else because I didn't make the dance team. So I loved dancing growing up.
Okay. It sounds like my daughter. She's the musical theater, drama, actor, art, and that's where she went. Now works as a reception by day and actress by night. So I don't know where she's going with it. But when did your passion kind of evolve to basketball?
Well, I was 5'8" in the fifth grade, 5'8". And I've been 6'1" since I was 12.
Wow.
Yep, for the same height. I'm 37 now, same height since I was 12. And so I was coming out of a store one day and this guy said, "Hey, do you play ball?" This is when I was in the seventh grade and I was like, "Yeah, of course I play." And he said, "Well, come try out for our team. We need some tall girls." Like, who doesn't need tall girls?
Yeah.
Especially when they're 6'1" and 12. And so I went and tried out and I was so bad, Glenn. I mean, terrible, because I hadn't really played before. So, but it was fun because I felt really awkward being that tall and being so young, but basketball became the place where I met other young women who were growing to be as tall as me. And I just felt comfortable.
Yeah, it's that early growth spurt. And I find that with girls more so than boys, because the growth maturation does change. I remember when I was in grade 7, I'll never forget, there was a girl in our class, grew to 6'2", and she became a model at like 14, 15, and she was traveling the world. Everybody's talking about, where'd she go? Well, she came back, and then she got married, what have you. But that fast pace, so you're catching up to your body, I'm guessing. And yeah. When did you really start feeling comfortable with your motor skills for sport?
It's so funny that you asked that. Tumping over my feet when I was a junior and senior in high school, right? I just happened to work hard. So when did I feel comfortable? Probably when I got to college. I had to learn how to run. I didn't know how to run. They would joke and say that it looked like I was skating. I was like gliding down the court. I didn't know. I was just going. So I didn't learn mobility, mechanics, and agility until college. So 18, 19.
So is that because no one showed you, or is it just that you couldn't catch up to your body?
Well, we didn't have all the agility and mobility training that they have these days. I mean, yeah. We just played. And so I was talented enough, obviously, to get a Division I scholarship, and I worked really hard, but I was not the most athletic kid. So I think part of it was just the function of not knowing that it was possible to learn how to run or to learn some different mechanics of the body.
Gotcha. So when did the light bulb go on that the NCAA path was the one you really wanted to pursue?
It went on when I was in the eighth grade, and I received my first letter from the University of Memphis. We had come back from a summer tournament somewhere, and I was like, oh my God, I have a letter from college. Now, my parents didn't go to college. I have older brothers. They're me, they weren't being recruited at all. And so it was a pretty big deal. And then, you know, I saw like University of Tennessee on TV all the time. This is when women's basketball was just getting some airtime. Shamequa Holzclaw, Tamika Catchings, and I saw them and thought, oh, I would like to be that. But I didn't know it could be a reality for me until I got that letter.
Yeah, they had a pretty good coach in Tennessee.
Sadly,
passed away. She won a few championships. Probably one of the most quoted. I think Pat was one of the greatest of all time, and a lot of people say it is John, but she did an amazing job with that program. And one of the things I loved about her, she's a big believer in no one cares how much you know until they know how much you care, and how she connected with her athletes. So that kind of precursed the next question. You went from the NCAA path, got into coaching. So top three characteristics that you feel from your past life as an athlete and now coaching, what are they? Great coaches.
Top three characteristics of coaches.
Yeah. What would they be?
One, you have to have high standards of excellence. That's essential. Two, you have to be competent and know what you're talking about. That's important. And then three, the players have to know that you care. You have to care more about players as people and not only as athletes.
And where did you see that at the NCAA level? Because I know I was talking to somebody, Dr. Jerry Lynch is part of this event. He works with a lot of NCAA teams. He goes, you know, the collegiate level, one and done. Like, if you're coaching, you've got to win. So how hard is it to juggle that winning, but also the caring and all the other transformational aspects of coaching at that level?
It is the most important piece. Relationships are everything. I mean, you can't win if the players don't buy in. That's part of being a leader, is players buying into whatever you're teaching them or the system. And if they don't know that you care, then you're not going to get them to fully buy in. And it's hard, but it is, you know, your livelihood is contingent upon 18 to 22 year olds making good decisions. So there's some stress that comes along with that.
So are you, or have you read the book Mindset? Do you know much about growth mindset, Carol Dweck's work?
I've heard about growth mindset. Mm-hmm. So, I haven't read the book though.
Okay, so how important it then is, and from a coaching perspective, mistakes at the winning level, at the NCAA, patience and repetitions, because you've got to allow for that to happen, and do you encourage it as a coach, or is it like you're beyond that?
Gosh, that's a tough one. I think part of it is, you know, you expect players to be paying attention. So it's one thing if you're not focused and paying attention and you're making these mistakes that you're capable and competent enough to not make. It's another thing when you're struggling with a concept, when a player is struggling with a concept and they're really trying to understand and they're making mistakes, you know. And there's a few ways of teaching. I think part of what makes great coaches is they understand what players need, like what makes them tick. And different people have different learning styles. Some people, you need to write it and they need to see it on the board. Some people need to actually see it on film. People just learn differently. And I think it does players and teams a disjustice when we only assume that if we tell them, they'll get it. And oftentimes that's the last way that they're gonna get it.
Yeah, it's just because you taught it, they haven't necessarily learned it. You know, that whole board concept, some kids will, you know, I'm mainly in the hockey space, but also done a bunch of other sports. They'll see the drill and they'll go, okay, I get it. But sometimes they need to hear it. Sometimes they need to see it demonstrated. Sometimes they need to see their team do it. So you can't just assume that. And I'm trying to get grassroots coaches understand just starting out. That's a tough one because they just assume, oh, I wrote up the drill. They know what to do. No. NCAA girls or women is what you've coached is – any big differences coaching female at the female level versus say the male level? Cause there are differences. I believe, I'm just kind of curious from your perspective, what coaches should be looking for when they're coaching female athletes.
So I've never coached on the men's side, but there are young men who I work with, who I train personally. And so a few differences, the game is the same, but a few differences is guys are playing above the rim. So you have to coach to things that are possible above the rim, you know? So the expectations there are a little different in terms of size, strength, and athleticism. Right. With women, I think that in general, women are more team oriented. We're just wired to want to be a part of a team and value being able to express ourselves. So I think making sure that young women have a voice and sharing what they're thinking matters. Specifically with the young women I work with, the boys, like they don't, they're tired of hearing me talk. Like they just want to go out and beat someone up. Whereas the women, you know, they want to share what's going on in their mind. And so in some of those ways, they need to be coached a little different. And we have hormones. That's a real thing. That happened. So
yeah, and you know, I've coached both. I've coached girls and I've coached boys, and ironically, right at the same age group, it was really different. Kind of your path, where they were 8 year old, not quite to 12, 13, where you had your huge growth spurt. But I coached 8 year old boys, and then I did a girls' jamboree with 8 year old girls, and the girls were about 6 inches taller. And yep. It was amazing when I called them into the board. Said, okay, girls, come on in, and boom, they were in. They had the water bottles. They're on a knee. They paid attention. I have boys at that age group that were still doing snow angels on the ice. Like the maturity was a huge shift. The social, I totally agree with. What I found too with girls is a lot of times they'll pair up. They always have kind of a buddy on teams. And if the one piece of advice I got from a coach two summits back is never single them out either to provide praise or to, you know, negative criticism. Is that true?
Yep, it is. I've seen that. I have a niece who's 10, and my brother and I coached her team, her fourth and fifth grade team, and girls just bond with girls in different ways. Boys will come up and punch each other, and then they're friends, whereas little girls, they talk, and they're connected to each other. Yeah, they don't want to be, little girls quite often don't want to feel like they're better than another person. They take that pretty seriously. They may feel it and know that their skill level, but they don't want to be put on the spot to say that you're better. Whereas boys, totally different mindset when it comes to that.
Yeah, so almost don't want to have like MVP awards and tournaments for girls because it does single them out versus boys are always looking for that, right? That's something that maybe we have to look at in the space.
We're just wired differently. I mean, women and men just wired differently.
Yeah, the old, I don't know, I can't remember if I got the name of the book, The Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus, and yep. My wife frazzes me all the time. Well, I told you that. I said, no, you didn't. You know, and like 25 years later, no, you didn't. But it is what it is, right?
It is.
So let's talk a little bit about your path going in from play professional basketball, going coaching, and now you're focusing on the whole recruiting segment. And I was really interested when you reached out to me. I was like, I've never really talked to anybody from a coach for recruiting the athletes and the pros and cons. So what's the main work that you're doing? That's number one. And number two, what if there's aspiring girls, particularly those ones you're working for, that want to play collegiately, what are some tips that you would share for them and their parents?
Sure. So there are about 1% of high school athletes play Division I sports, you know, and about 5% play college sports altogether. But there are a lot of them playing younger, and they want to know about the process. And a lot of times they sit and wait. So I surveyed over 100 parents about the college recruiting process, specifically who have daughters that play basketball, right? And only 20% said they felt very prepared. So that really propelled my desire to give workshops, seminars, and provide resources for families so that they can better understand and feel more confident when it comes to recruiting. There are these five phases that I came up with to help make this process a little more seamless. The first is an assessment. You have to assess her physical health, her mental health, her academics, her skill set. Do an assessment first, and then come up with a plan, which is the second phase. Come up with a plan for each one of those areas, and then collect information around different schools, go on visits. I'm a big proponent of unofficial visits. You need to get out there and see what schools exist and what opportunities are there. So I'm in St. Louis, right? There are some people who are interested in Division II schools, but you can't get to a school in Florida because the season actually starts today. the high school season. Well, go visit the Division II school in St. Louis. Get an idea of what questions you may ask a school that's not here if you call them and talk to them, you know, so you have some context. And then after that, you evaluate. After you collect the information, you evaluate based on what's important to you. So sometimes parents want to evaluate based on what other people may think is the best decision, but it's really about who is your daughter? What does she need? If you know she needs a small group because of 40,000 kids on a campus will make her highly uncomfortable and that's not best for her, then a smaller school, regardless of if that big school is in a great conference or whatever the program may be, you have to be honest about who your daughter is or son, you know, and then make your decision. So those are the five phases.
Okay, the only problem is, and I'm going to have to maybe figure out how we're going to redo, catch you on that. We've got some buffering challenges. Are you on Wi-Fi?
I am.
I also am, but mine's been very, like, I'm like literally 4 feet from my router, so it's usually on the other side. I got about two-thirds of that, and there's been a little bit of choppiness, but I have someone to edit this, so
okay,
maybe, I don't know, I hate to have you to redo it, but I'm also, do you have bars on your, like, you can check and see how stable your connectivity is?
Yeah, it says, I just got a signal saying it's unstable. I mean,
we can edit. So, like, I can copy paste and stuff like that, but of the, you said five, I heard two for sure. Yeah. The other three were kind of like, and then kind of stopped, and then, so if you want to reshare, because that's the whole point of what we're trying to do is focus on the great work that you're doing. So
do you want me to
I mean, do you have the ability to plug in? Can you plug in anywhere?
I can't. Let me see. Do you want me to log out and log back in, or is that helpful?
We could try that if you want. I can stay in the room and you can log out, log back in, and with the recording, we'll just keep going. Do you want to try that?
Okay. Yeah, let me try that. Oh, I'm turned. Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Sorry. Oh no, hold on. Sorry about that.
No, no worries.
Can you hear me now?
I can and see you. More of a close up than prior.
So I just shifted to my cell phone. I had a Zoom call earlier on my phone and it worked perfectly.
Yeah.
So
yeah, everything now is like one of the buffering issues. Sometimes, you know, when your lips are moving and then 3 seconds later, it's like the echo chamber. So we're a lot better now and, you know, no problem. I have a student that's actually a videographer that's doing all the editing, even though Zoom does a pretty good job going the back and forth. But I hate when I wanted you to be able to share everything you got and it was like, okay, so I think we're good now. So if you could reshare that and then we could keep going.
Okay, sure, happily. So there are five phases of the recruiting process that I've come up with. The first phase is the assessment phase. And in the assessment phase, there are different areas that parents need to assess. First, they need to assess their child's physical well-being. I know an 11-year-old whose hip pops out of the socket when she walks.
Wow.
Yes, she has a lot of miles on her legs already. And I said to her, Dad, she needs to not play for a while till you figure out why that's happening and get her the mobility training. And she's a tall kid, so she's getting used to her body, but we don't want her to have a hip replacement at 20, you know? Yeah. So assess their body, the physical body, assess their mental health, their ability to handle pressure, stress, assess their love for the game. You know, parents invest a lot of money, Glenn. It can get pretty expensive. Plan on select teams. If your kid never asks to go to the gym, there's a chance that they don't love it. They may just want to play when they go to practice and play for fun, and that's okay too. But in terms of playing college, if they don't love it, you need to assess that and be honest about that. You need to assess them academically, of course, see how they're doing, and then assess what skills they need to improve on. So the assessment process is key. That's one. The second phase is the plan. Come up with a plan like we do for everything. You make an assessment, you come up with a plan for how to get better. So if they need physical therapy, get that. If they need support in math, do that. If they need to go see a therapist or a sports psychologist, make that happen. And if they really are serious, they love the game, they've demonstrated that they love the game, then maybe you find some additional training or some, you know, someone who can, a skill developer, if those are areas of their game they want to get better at. And then we start collecting data. So we go visit campuses, we check out college basketball games, we go to practices, and we're just getting information. Maybe if they're a junior, if they're a sophomore or a junior, you're going to elite camps, you're meeting coaches, you're building relationships. And you're really going, maybe even then you're going to expose your events. You know, you're playing on a select team and you're gathering information about the schools. And then you evaluate based on who your daughter is and what she needs. So she might need to be in a place. I gave a presentation the other day and a parent about the recruiting process. And a parent asked, what happens if your kid has a 504 plan or an IEP? Is that disclosed?
A lot of people are watching this from Canada, so that flew over my head like the Concorde. So what is that?
So an IEP is an individualized education plan.
Okay.
So they just need additional supports. And a 504 is the same thing without as much. It's a 504 plan. So it's saying your child is legally allowed to get additional time for taking tests because of a reading disability, potentially.
Gotcha.
So okay. Having those academic supports. So part of the evaluation process is knowing your child, and maybe your child just needs those supports, and you want to make sure that the universities honor those, you know, education plans and have the resources available. And okay. then the last phase is you make your decision. The decision that's best for your child and decision that's best for your family. It's usually a family, the whole family's impacted when the kid goes to college. It's not just the child.
Yeah, especially when they're going cross country and mm-hmm. kind of touched on early on, it is a big investment on the family's part. And one of the biggest challenges we're having in this space, and I love the fact that you said, if they don't love it and they're really not pursuing it, but parents,
yeah,
are aspiring for them to get there, there's a huge disconnect. So what I share with all parents, regardless of where I am, is one, the realities of getting that level is tough. But second is making sure that you're asking your kids, what do you really want to do with this? Like, do you want your athletic to keep going beyond college or whatever the case may be? Or do you just want to play with your buddies and have fun? So if it's the latter, support them to do that. And you talk to any really high level athlete, and I suspect the same hold true with your parents, probably were really big behind the scenes helping you get to where you wanted to be. Is that true?
My parents made sure that I had the opportunities. Absolutely. My parents didn't go to college. They never played college sports. So once the letters started rolling in, it was new to all of us. However, if I said, Mom, this is important to me, she supported me. Dad, I want to go to this camp. They were supportive. I have older brothers who are identical twins. They actually ended up playing at JUCO and then transferring to a Division II school, and all of their education was paid for as well. But yeah, the whole family was influential in my ability to pursue my goals, no question.
Yeah, without that support, kids won't get there. But there's that fine line, though. Some parents, and you're probably running into this, that they're taking it a little over the top, and it's taking over the top early. And one of the things that we hear about all the time, like the NCAA recruiting is a lot different than the Canadian recruiting process, where only lacrosse, to the best of my knowledge, has a hard cap. You can't look at kids and can't have any dialogue or offering any kind of a scholarship or what have you. until they're, I think, 15. But mm-hmm. other sports, they're still kind of and the youngest I know of to date was a 9-year-old phenom football player, got offered a full ride at University of Nevada. I'm like, 9 in tackle football. Yes. So 9 years from now, there's going to be possibly he's not even going to be physically able to play. So
exactly.
Where's the fine line?
I'm so glad you said that. It is exciting for parents and players when you get offered a scholarship when you're 15 or 6, freshman, sophomore, or even 8th grade, but they're meaningless. As someone who coached college basketball, they are literally meaningless because it's contingent upon so many factors. The first thing is contingent upon that coach still being there. There's a high probability that the coach will leave.
So the coach, if the coach have made that verbal or whatever the case, they have to honor that commitment.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, they don't have to honor it because verbal agreements aren't binding.
Mm-hmm.
They're nice, but they are not binding. The second thing is, it's contingent upon the kid being admitted into the school. We're saying, if I'm a college coach and I offer a scholarship to a 9th grader, I'm saying, I trust and believe that you're going to get your grades, you're going to do well on the ACT, you know, you're going to do all of these things, and then I will honor it. And so it's flattery. It's flattery. However, it's essential that players don't relax if they're one of the younger players getting that. I know a young lady right now who relaxed and is regretting it.
Hmm.
So by the time she got there, she wasn't ready because she thought they needed her. Her words, not mine. She literally thought they needed her and got there and realized. And it was, her freshman year was tough.
Wow. So I'm glad you answered that question because
yes.
I've had that conversation with many a parent saying, you know, and the other part of the component, and you already touched on it, is the academic side of it.
Mm-hmm.
You could have all the athletic schools in the world. Gone are the days where they let you coast in the NCAA or even in Canada and universities with a gentleman's seat. Like joke that me and a buddy have, we both went to the University of British Columbia. We both graduated with kinesiology degrees. But both of us were kind of like the 80%-ish.
Uh-huh.
And now to get into that school, the 93% average.
Wow.
Like I wouldn't be able to go to that school now because, you know, I also wanted to work and I was an athlete and that stuff, so forth. So how important is the academic side for student athletes?
Mm-hmm. The academic side is essential. I mean, I really believe that parents, as you assess quarterly or even twice a year, if you know that your child is struggling in math, especially as an 8th grader, if they're struggling as an 8th grader, the courses that they take in the 8th grade determine the courses that they're going to take in high school, the placement that they get put in. And the NCAA only accepts certain courses for your eligibility. So if your child ends up in a math class that the NCAA doesn't recognize as a freshman, then they have to play catch up in order to make sure they have the required courses to then get that scholarship if they're one of the lucky few that gets offered one. So it's serious. It's really serious.
Yeah, so the emphasis should be on both, right? As being well-rounded, make sure that you focus on your academics. Yeah. Otherwise, it's going to hold you back. You
it
could
will.
End up getting that scholarship, but they're not going to allow you in. I heard that NCAA raised the GPA, used to be 2.3. Is it 2.6 now? Or did they raise it? Is it still 2.3?
It used to be 2.0.
And now it's 2.3, right?
Yep.
Okay. So are they talking about continuing to raise it, or is that kind of where it's going to be at for the time being?
To my knowledge, it's where it's at now because it was a raise. But, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if academic standards continue to increase. There's ongoing pressure to make sure the student athletes are graduating and doing well, and that's part of that movement and initiative.
How hard was it for you when you were going to college to be academic and be the athlete?
I was a really good student, and I learned, I don't know where I learned this, but I learned how to plan well academically. So I tell young people, As soon as you get all of your syllabi for the semester, write down all of, I was just a diligent student, man. I can't even front. Like, I was just a good kid.
So like I would write down all of my tests and papers, and then I would put in all of my games. So I could see when I had games, when I had tests, when I would be on the road, and then I was able to plan accordingly. So if I had a big paper, I would mark a week ahead, paper in a week. So if it was, and then if I had a game, so I was able to plan well and do well. But at the Division I level, you know, you have mandatory study hall. So there are people ensuring that you're able to balance and you figure it out.
Did you ever watch the movie Coach Carter?
Yes.
What was your take on that? Because I've been a big believer that academics, for me, there's three priorities. Family first, academics second, sports always third. And I love that movie. What was your spin on when he had the kids sign the contract and enforced it because they weren't getting their grades? Because that's setting them up for college, right?
It is. What we want ultimately is for young people. We're here. What we want ultimately is for young people to be self-directed and to be able to prioritize. And I love that he made them do that. You son, your word is everything. Integrity matters so much. And making sure that young people honor their word, you learn like that basic value, honoring your word, sets you up for the rest of your life. It sets a high standard for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's kind of the space you're in, not more so with the female athletes and helping them in that pathway. So maybe shed a little bit more the books that you wrote. How long did it take you to write them? And B, what was the driving reason for doing it?
Sure. So the first book, The Game Changing Assist, was birthed out of a speech that I gave when I was coaching at Southeast Missouri State University. And I was asked to speak to a group of students, and the night before I was pacing, trying to figure out what I'm gonna talk about. And then it came to me, vision, voice, valley, value, victory, and volunteering. Like that was the framework. So I talked about having a vision for your future, listening to positive voices, overcoming the valley, reaching the point of victory and volunteering. And the kids loved it. Like they're high schoolers. I was surprised, but they really liked the speech. And so I kept giving that same speech to a bunch of different kids and they liked it. And my mom, you know what mamas do? They say, you should do this, baby. You can do that. So my mom told me I should write a book and I dismissed it. And then eventually I just started writing. And it took me a couple of years to actually get it to the point that I felt really comfortable, confident, and happy with.
Yeah.
So that one was 2 years. And then I created a workbook to go along with it that can be used with teams and after school groups and community-based organizations, so we can really help young people do activities connected to the concepts of the book. So for example, the chapter on vision, the activity is a vision board. So you literally create the vision that you want for your life. My favorite activity is around the chapter on values. And the idea is getting young people to understand what it takes to get to wherever they want to be. Like your values have to align with your vision. And so sometimes they just don't know though, Glenn. So I ask them to find an all-star team and a cheer squad. Your all-star team are those people who are where you want to be, right? They are if you're interested in sports psychology, be a sports psychologist. Find some sports psychologists and ask them these specific questions that are listed in the workbook. If you are interested in coaching, whatever it is, find your all-star team. Then your cheer squad, those are people like your mama. Who's gonna tell you the job? Who's gonna tell you, baby, you can do it? They may not have walked the path that you're headed, but they have wisdom and you're gonna need them. So you have these two groups of people to help you get there. So that was the first book, The Game Changing Assist. And then the third book, for the book in the workbook, Post Moves, was really exciting because I didn't really think through how I was going to transition from college. Honestly, I had no idea. I remember standing in front of the mirror the day of graduation thinking,
got a degree, now what?
Oh God, this is over. It's over. What am I going to do with my life? I knew I wanted to play ball. But you know how it is when you play internationally. You don't know when you're leaving. Nor do you have a contract, nor do you have any money. So people would ask me, like, hey, where are you going? I was like, overseas. And they'd be like, when are you going? I mean, I don't know. And they would look at me crazy. Now I understand why. I get it. So So anyway, Post Moves was an attempt to help young women not make all the same mistakes I made regarding preparation for graduation. And I realized that one of the missing links is mentors. That's really what's missing, is not having people who can help show you the path and open doors for you. So I interviewed 15 women, various backgrounds. Some of them were international as well, various sports, who had all played college sports. And they shared their experience about transition, about leadership, about life, about their current career. And the best part about the book, all of them agreed to have their contact information listed. So young women who are in college can now walk away with literally a handful of mentors who've all agreed to reach out to them or to be available for them.
Yeah, and that's also really important in the coaching space too. Like I've asked the question, I'll ask it of you and see what you come up with, because it kind of tags on that exact subject. If you wanted a coach to shave, and I had about five people last time ask this question, why would you want them to do this? How do you shave 5 years off your learning curve as a coach? What would you do?
I would go and talk to coaches who've done it, who've been coaching. I would go learn from them, be their assistants, do whatever.
Go and basically find a mentor, right? And yeah, it's funny, I had a couple of people say, well, they should learn through trial and error, and da da da. I'm like, well, as we're learning as coaches, though, what happens is those kids might get caught in the crossfire, regardless if you're, no matter what level, you're at the NCAA, it's pretty high level, you know, grassroots before that. But those kids may be pushed out of the game because you said something wrong or lack of experience or whatever the case may be. So I'm a big believer. No, I want to make sure that we keep kids in the game. I want them beloved before the end of the season they did in the beginning. And then and pursue your kind of path. So how long did you play internationally? Where did you go?
I was in Germany. I was there a year and then came back and decided to get married at 22, which is a whole nother podcast.
Okay. I'll leave that one where it is.
But it's the truth. It's the truth. It's what happened. I came back and then started coaching and went to graduate school.
Okay. So now that you I don't know where to go with that.
I know. I used to like skim over it, but I'm like, why not? This is what happened. I was missing the love of my life at 22 and I came back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now in this era, 22 is young. Like,
oh man,
my generation maybe, but like mid-20s, like now it's like 30s.
Yeah.
And say, so I didn't want to wait. And my wife and I also didn't want to wait to have kids because I wanted to be able to coach them when I was older.
Right.
And I see a lot of, I just did a clinic on the weekend and I had 40-year-old new parents with 40-year-olds. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, you know, it's kind of a big shift. You know,
that it is. Time,
so.
It is. I'm 37. I don't have kids at all. Nope. It's different. But back in the day, there was, you know, you wouldn't have, it would be more of an anomaly than now.
Yeah, I mean, and we talk about a whole bunch of other non-related sports things, but the world has changed and evolved and what have you. But what was your most favorite memory from the professional career / NCAA? What did you love the most out of it?
Going to Germany, seeing the world. I mean, I'd never traveled abroad. I mean, when I was a kid, we only traveled on Greyhound bus from St. Louis to Tennessee or from St. Louis to Mississippi. Like, we never flew on planes, you know, and we never went anywhere where family didn't live.
Yeah.
And so playing ball and leaving the country, my family thought I was nuts. And it was incredible to go to Paris and to Finland and to Sweden. Oh man, the people you meet, the recognition that you can make it out here in the world on your own. And I was 21 at the time. I mean, it was huge for my overall development.
Yeah, and it's funny, I just had a coach in my clinic this weekend from Germany.
Okay.
And very thick German accent, but his English was very good. I'm like, and how long have you been here? 1 year. I'm like, whoa. Like, your English, he goes, but they take English as second language because many of them are, you know, that's part of their education system. But he played professional hockey for a number of years and said the same thing. The reason I wanted to stay here is I got to play on all these different, you know, countries in Europe, whereas in North America, we're going from, like, you know, Florida to New York. And
exactly.
It's not quite the same because you have that opportunity to travel here. But I know a few people that did that. And that's kind of something I missed out on, was doing that international travel segment. But this going back, you can't change it. But I'm glad you had that experience. So you come back, you said you went to graduate school. What was your focus?
I did. Communication.
Okay.
Communication in graduate school and started coaching. So I coached at a local high school. Oh, geez. Gosh, what year was that? So 15 years? We're at about 14, 15 years.
Been in gyms. You started out in high school and then got into college, collegiate?
I did. Yeah, you know, I tell kids all the time, you never know why people cross your path. Are going to show back up, so be good to people. A lot of the really early coaching opportunities that I got were from former coaches that I had who are still coaching.
Yeah, and they're probably going to be your greatest asset because they're going to help and they'll mentor you, believe in you, and what have you. It's tough for coaches to start out when they don't have that infrastructure or the people to go to when they have the issues, right? So that's my number one recommendation to every coach: find a mentor. Like right out of the gate, like find somebody, because I still have them, and I'm really, really happy that I can reach out. Hey, how do you deal with this? Right? Otherwise, you're just kind of, the kids might get hurt because you do something you didn't intentionally want to do wrong. So
true.
From a girl's perspective, specific, because that's your wheelhouse. How important is it? And I've seen a lot of collegiate coaches talk about this. Multi-sport versus the early specialization conundrum that we're in now.
Yeah.
Where do we go with that? Like, I'm kind of curious from your perspective, because you kind of got in early because of your growth and maturity, but you had that love for dance early, so at least you got the mofundamomu. So what's your take on the early specialization model?
I think early specialization is to the detriment of kids. They're specializing way too early, and it creates these overuse injuries. ESPN had two-part series of articles around. The title was something like, these kids are a ticking time bomb. Yeah. And they interviewed an orthopedic surgeon and talked about the prevalence of ACL tears and meniscus and just all the injuries that kids are having. They can't do squats and lunges because their mobility is and their core strength isn't focused on. So I think kids should play multiple sports until at least high school. And I am a big proponent of designated rest period. You don't have to play all year round on four teams. Like, you cannot possibly be a great teammate to four teams of people. It's not possible.
Yeah, there's at the same time, because we call those players the fly-ins.
Mm-hmm.
They go to one team, they hop, they don't go to any practices. Oh, no, I got this commitment. I
have a kid. Everyone hates them. Yeah. No one likes those kids.
Yeah, and a lot of the NCAA coaches that I've had an opportunity to connect with, they're going after multi-sport athletes because the overuse, development of the fundamental movement skills. Yep. You know, a perfect example right now, Zion Williamson is drafted at Duke, and he's out with another injury, and he's torn meniscus in his knee, and everybody's saying, hey, you know, maybe he's not going to have the career that he potentially could because he was one of those specialized. He right from the get-go, and I've seen that statistic. Like the NBA, there's in an article that they shared, they looked at those that specialized in grade 8 that they decided in once they got into, was it middle school in the U.S.? And then once they specialized, when they got to college, the ones that specialized at college, longer playing careers, much less injuries, you know, they weren't suffering the major issues we see today.
Exactly. So, well, what's even more intriguing is that I know a bunch of people around this group who are tearing their Achilles because they have so many miles on them already. So, you know, it's one of those situations where if you put all the miles early, you're still going to have to live with your body, you know, when you get older. So there isn't enough focus on recovery and caring for your body as there is a focus on performance and working out. And recovery and caring for your body is exponentially more important because you're going to have your body forever, but you won't be able to perform forever.
Yeah, and you look at most of the professional athletes, and the analogy I give to all parents, they all rest in their off season.
They do.
All of them, all the professional sports, they're not going year round. Like, there's a reason why they stop for 3 or 4 yep. months. Okay, mm-hmm. and we're just going to hang out at a lake or hang out with our buddies because their bodies have to regenerate from a really intense long season. How long is basketball seasons NCAA? Is it 8 months or 4 months or is the whole course?
Well, it really never. So the actual playing season is from they started practice sooner. So playing season starts now from late October, November through March. But there's preseason pretty much within a few weeks. The kids are on campus, they're working out. They may have a week or two off in the spring and then postseason workouts. And they're usually on campus 8 weeks in the summer and you can practice with the team a few times a week. I mean, they've really beefed up the number of hours that players can work out, which a lot of coaches think is excessive, but they're still going to have their kids do it because it's allowable. So it's
all
right.
But all the research and all the data, and you're just saying the rest recovery. So how do we curb that? How do you change? If the NCAA is pushing their kids to almost go year round, how does the trickle down to mom and dad at a grassroots level? They got a 12-year-old kid or even an 8-year-old kid. Well, yeah. The NCAA is doing it. So how do we change that model?
Well, with the NCAA allowing players to come and practice in the Division One. So Division One is a really small number of players and teams. The vast majority of college athletes aren't playing NCAA Division One, and they're getting rest periods, and there are opportunities for them to have a bit more balance between sport and life. But how do we get moms and dads to be okay with knowing that there's not a fear of missing out? I think I have the answer. I just got it. It just dawned on me. If the summer league coaches would do less, if the select coaches would say, no, we're not going to do this much, we're not going to play in every tournament, then there would be less. But you know what, Glenn? We have shoe companies involved, which we hadn't talked about. And I'm not anti-shoe company, because their money provides opportunities for some kids who might not have it. However, you know, youth sports is big business. And so there's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, now in the U.S., a $17 billion business.
It is.
What's your take on the recent news that NCAA is going to allow for players to be compensated?
I'm interested to see how that rolls out and in what going to be able to be compensated. And, you know, I think it's great that players will be compensated. I remember having to sign my national letter of intent my scholarship renewal every year. You sign national letter of intent once, but every year we go in this little room and agree again to give our image and likeness away amongst other things. And so it's pretty cool that athletes at least will have an opportunity to gain some revenue. The big schools make a lot of money.
Yeah, and then you look at that whole scandal that happened, people buying into the programs because they want their kids to be at that level. So it's this whole vicious circle, right? But I love the fact that early in the conversation, you're talking about that love for the game. So what did you stop playing because you lost the love, or you go to coaching because you want to try something different, or what was your reasons for that?
Glenn, I told you I stopped playing back and got married because I was in love. that's why I stopped playing. However, my love for the game has never waned. Regardless of who I was
in.
Glenn, regardless of who I was in love with or out of love with, basketball, that love has remained. And so I've always just loved being in between the lines, coaching kids. So
you want to stay in the space. Like a lot of coaches I ask, you know, do you still love the game? We'd all love to keep playing, but once you get to a certain age or a family circumstance or whatever, so getting back, your big focus now is helping the girls that are aspiring to get there, the parents that are trying to get there through the books you've written. So are you continuing in workshops and all that kind of stuff? Is that your
workshops? Workshops around the college recruiting process. And I still run clinics and private lessons. I just love being in the gym with a bunch of kids and teaching the game and hear the balls bouncing. That does my soul well. So I love that. And yep, and speaking and training. Yep.
Typical day for you? Is there one?
No, every day is so different. Every day is so different, but I'm typically in the gym or I'm interviewing with people on podcasts or I am working on a new project.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, the books, I'd love to get them and I'm going to plug them at the bottom of this video. So the way it'll work. Just got one last question before rapid fire. What are some of the red flags for coaches when they're looking at potential players, when you're going to recruit them, that jump out at you, that, that's not going to work. This player is not going to be a good player.
Oh, lack of coachability is number one. When their coach says something to them, or do they roll their eyes? Do they make eye contact? Body language is huge. The other thing is when a mistake happens, how quickly do they bounce back? Are they sulking the next three possessions? Or are they so focused on themselves that they're not connected to their team? Those are two big ones. Those are the first two that came to mind.
Yeah, the coachability is always, you know, it comes up there because, and where does that come from? Do you think parents could help their kids a little bit better in that respect? Or is it just coming from that inner drive of the kid or they're non-responsive?
A combination of both. I mean, respect can be taught and enforced. We know that. But that can be taught and enforced. Everyone's family situation is a little different. So where they get taught respect, who knows where that comes from? But yeah, there has to be an influential adult who can help. But then some kids, you know, man, like, you just can't do anything.
Yeah.
You try, but they're going to do what they want anyway.
And they could aspire to get to the highest level possible, but the coaches read that and see that all the time. That's why I try to tell parents that, you know, that whole aspiration got to come from within their heart. Yeah. Like they had their drive, like yourself. Like, I mean, you wanted to get to it. Your parents supported you. Instead of the parents say, you're going to do this and you're going to specialize year round, and because you're going to burn them out. Because that's the other red flag with the whole specialization. You want them loving it all the way through. And even when they get married, you want them loving it beyond that.
Exactly. Right? Well, you know what, Glenn? It's really key that love develops over time. Sometimes parents and coaches as well want kids to love it immediately. Mm-hmm. I have a niece who is 10. For the first couple of years that she came around basketball, she had never went to a women's basketball game, never went to a clinic. I would try to get her to do things. She wouldn't do it. She finally just agreed. Because some of her teammates decided to go to this clinic at the university where I played. Mm. But it took years. And so you have to be patient and let love develop, like any relationship, like it grows over time. So we have in that space.
Yeah, and that's that whole model. Is the American development model applicable to basketball? Because I know it's big with hockey, lacrosse. Not sure if they've implemented in the basketball space. So long-term development, is that a focus?
Tell me about it. What do you mean?
In the American development model with USA Hockey is they've now got age-appropriate training. They're kind of setting the bar in that space. I know soccer is going there. Lacrosse has got their model. In Canada, almost all of our national sports have a long-term athletic development model. So, for example, when the kids are between 6 and 12 years old, we're focusing on the fun element, the social element, keep them in the game. The coaches, they're not – doing systems and tactics and strategies. Or I would love to see for no scorekeeping, like the one sport that's already done it in Canada is they've eliminated the scoreboard U12 in soccer. So the parents aren't being driven by that winning, you know, scoreboard and all that kind of stuff. And other sports are kind of looking at it going, should we go there? Norway is another perfect example. They don't allow their kids to compete until 13. And they won 39 medals in the Winter Olympics last year, all-time winners country. Sweden's another country, so more in the hockey space. But it sounds like the LTA, our long-term athletic development model, whether it's American development adapted, is it in basketball where they're kind of reinforcing, you know, it takes years for you to develop all your core skills.
Well, I know that USA Basketball has some, what's the word I'm looking for? Some initiatives in place, as well as the Junior NBA. So if you go to juniornba.com, they have a lot of age-appropriate skill development drills, and it kind of gives you some benchmarks on what kids should be able to do at what age. Now, the extent to which people use those resources is difficult to mandate, considering how high stakes basketball is.
Yeah, especially because of scholarships and also the salaries. And even Raptors won the championship. So now Canada's like, oh, we want our kids to go to the NBA.
Yeah, yep, absolutely.
So rapid fire. As a coach, what's your favorite book?
Favorite book is, my favorite book is...
Maybe you want to back up your phone a little bit because you're getting more half headshot.
Uh-oh. Well, hello?
There you go. That's better.
Okay. Gosh, I saw this and I was thinking about the time. Like, there's a book, Pat Summitt has a book about, like, the dozens, like the 12 things like that every coach should know that helps make players better players.
That's Pat Summitt?
Yeah.
Okay. What about for parents? Because you're working with parents and giving them advice to help their kids to get to the collegiate level. Any resources or like books or what they're recommending for them? In addition to your books, of course.
Right. The first book that came to mind was mine, The Game Changing Assist. Just because it's all about life and helping young people create a framework for success that's beyond who they are as an athlete. And there's a component of service, which is creating more empathetic humans is important.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I had a great conversation with Jerry. I call him Jerry, but everyone calls him Dr. Jerry Lynch. And he's all about servant leadership and another person. And the servant aspect, I mean, that's what coaches do. We're in this space to help kids become better people, right? Not necessarily best athletes. And that's why I love what I was seeing in terms of all the stuff you're doing. And what would be your biggest, the proudest moment interacting with a student athlete, your accomplishment that you, to date, that you're proud of? Because you've probably interacted with hundreds, if not thousands of kids now, right?
So many. Yeah, so many. Proudest moment would have to be, this is a moment with a kid and her parent. So her mom comes up to me and says, my daughter has anxiety and we researched you. And I just want to thank you for being passionate about making sure she is a good person and supporting her in addition to what she does on the court. And this was recent. And I was like, my eyes welled up. I'm like, oh my God, you're welcome. That's why I'm here. It's just really being on the court and affirming when you can see in a young person's eyes that they know that you believe in them, it makes life feel so purposeful.
Yeah, and there's nothing better than when that kid comes around full circle down the road and they say, thank you.
Yes.
And that's what I share in every time I do something, thank the coaches, and that's where we're kind of at that point. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing. Thanks for being part of this podcast. Your work is amazing, absolutely amazing, and I highly encourage people to read the books, and how do they find you? How do they follow the great work that you're doing other than up the books?
So you can visit my website, AngelaRLewis.com. There's tons of recruiting resources, videos there. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter, ALewis_speaks, and then on Facebook, Angela Lewis. And every Wednesday, I have a Facebook Live Recruiting Wednesday session. So.
Okay, cool. We'll make sure we put all that stuff at below this. Thank you so much for doing this. And
thank you.
Stay tuned.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook for Love of the Game, Twitter, TLOTG Conference, and forlovethegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.